From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Another blow to bipartisanship. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. George Washington told Thomas Jefferson, the Senate should be the saucer that catches and cools the heated overflow from the House of Representatives. In the Senate, minority party rights have been protected by requiring that some measures need 60 votes instead of just 51 in order to pass. But over the years, both parties have eroded that rule, especially regarding judicial confirmations, and this week it's happening again. What will approval of President Trump's first appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court mean in the long run for both political parties? Today, on our Talking Point later, Mar-a-Lago is now the Winter White House, a profitable new brand for the resort owner in chief. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Senate Democrats today blocked Judge Neil Gorsuch's appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court, but just for the moment. The Republican majority has changed the rules to force a likely confirmation as soon as tomorrow. We'll hear all about that as we go forward. Today's talking point later, Mar-a-Lago is now called the Winter White House, another branding triumph for America's resort owner-in-chief. This week's summit meeting with China's Xi Jinping is Donald Trump's sixth high-profile visit there since he was inaugurated. What's the bill for American taxpayers? First, this news update. California Republican Devin Nunes has recused himself as chair of the House Intelligence Committee while it investigates Russian interference in last year's election. He's also being investigated himself by the Ethics Committee. Allie Watkins is national security reporter for BuzzFeed. Always good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Let's walk through this slowly here. What is it that Mr. Nunes is being investigated for by the Ethics Committee?
I mean, this is the grand irony in the whole scenario right now, is that Devin Nunes is being investigated by the Ethics Committee for inappropriately disclosing classified information. And we don't know really anything past the fact that he's being investigated, other than that there is a probe open. The committee, the Ethics Committee, did not want to comment any further than that.
But this came about when Nunes said that he had been to the White House grounds and gotten information that had some suggestion about people's names being improperly unmasked. And he took that to the president before he took it to his own committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this all stems from that really sensational press conference about 2 weeks ago when Devin Nunes came out publicly without informing any other committee members and said that he had received information from a source saying that he talked a lot about potential unmasking of U.S. persons and Trump campaign associates.
Okay, so now here's Adam Schiff. He's the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee. He's been calling for a recusal. Here's what he said today.
It will, I think, allow us to have a fresh start moving forward. I look forward to working with Mr. Conaway. Investigation is of such critical importance that we need to get fully back on track.
Mike Conaway, to whom he referred, is a Republican from Texas. So, Allie Watkins, he takes over for Nunes, but only, I take it, for the purposes of investigating the Trump Association, Trump Campaign Association with the Russians. Nunes stays on as the full-time chairman.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting structurally for the House Intelligence Committee moving forward because Nunes also did not permanently recuse himself. He just said he was going to temporarily step away from the Russia probe. So how this shakes out in the next few weeks, months is going to be really interesting.
Another shakeup that might or might not be related is, of course, Steve Bannon yesterday being removed from the principals group of the National Security Council. Is that related or do we know?
It doesn't appear to be related from everything I've heard, I haven't seen any indication that it is related at all. But it is worth bearing in mind, just with Bannon being taken off the National Security Council, he still has a lot of power. And to an extent, it's kind of been overhyped that he's been taken away from the National Security Council, because the guy can still walk right into the Oval Office. You know, he was never supposed to be on the National Security Council in the first place.
There was some indication that he was there to keep track of Mike Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, head of the office, who, of course, was dismissed. Now, does Paul Ryan, the Speaker, still say that he has confidence in Devin Nunes?
I think Ryan's statement today just kind of supported Nunes's decision to recuse himself from the probe. But Ryan's role in this is going to be really interesting, because the Ethics Committee has subpoena power. And if they're going to be looking into, you know, what Nunes knew, what he said, who knew what Nunes is going to say. You know, we know Devin Nunes talked to Paul Ryan before he had this big press conference. So that's going to be really interesting for Paul Ryan.
So that may bring the Speaker into the investigation by the Ethics Committee. Back to the Intelligence Committee. Are they going to hold open hearings now? Are we going to hear from the acting attorney general, or former acting attorney general, Sally Yates, and from the former director of National Intelligence, Clapper, and from John Brennan, who headed the CIA?
It sounds like they're really interested. I mean, Schiff's statement today, it sounds like they're really hoping for a kind of reset with the House Intelligence Committee probe. So there was obviously supposed to be that open hearing with Yates, CIA Director Brennan, and Director of National Intelligence Jim Clapper a while ago. It got canceled and all this political shakeup. I would expect that that open hearing is going to be rescheduled, certainly, as this reset kind of gets up and running.
Okay. And at the same time, of course, there's a parallel investigation going on the Senate side with the Intelligence Committee over there. They're trying to look like the adults in the room.
Yeah, they, even today, they are trying to stay as far away from the House as possible.
All right. So, Allie Watkins, again, always good to talk with you, national security reporter for BuzzFeed. It's going to be a lot of work to do in the next few weeks.
And it never stops.
Okay. Always look forward to talking to you. Thanks for being with us. In a moment, another blow to bipartisanship on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. Senate Democrats challenged Republicans today to put up or shut up by denying the 60 votes needed to confirm Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. Then the Republicans struck back. Republican John McCain said, "Someday we will regret what we are about to do," but he still joined fellow Republicans in eliminating the protection for minority party rights in the Senate. Once again, a supposedly hallowed tradition is being abandoned in the interests of politics. Stephen Dennis covers the Senate for Bloomberg News. Always good to have you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It's great to be here.
So there's 60 votes were needed to confirm Neil Gorsuch. There are not going to be 60 votes needed tomorrow. Why is this? What did the Republicans do?
Well, they basically overturned the rules. They overturned the ruling of the chair. And by doing so, they basically created a new precedent that you only need a simple majority to end a filibuster. So you can still have a filibuster, but it only lasts, you know, 30 hours or so. And then you got to vote, and the final vote will just be a simple majority for now all nominees. The Democrats did this for every nominee except for Supreme Court justices 4 years ago. And McConnell took it that one extra step, and of course, there's still the 60-vote threshold for legislation. That could be in danger at some point, because you can use the same procedure to overturn the rules on that as well. And that would be an even bigger shift in, you know, frankly, all of American politics, because so many things get clogged up with the filibuster these days.
This goes way back. George Washington reportedly said to Thomas Jefferson that the Senate would be the saucer that controls the heated stuff that overflows from the House of Representatives. But it wasn't really until the most 100 years ago or so that this filibuster idea came into being and the requirement for 60 votes. But it has been a hallowed tradition for a long time. Now, both parties have taken action to get rid of it.
Yeah, and while it was on the books for 100 years, it was almost never used for nominees. It was all, you know, with Clarence Thomas, for example, people remember that case. You know, he was not filibustered. Not a single Democrat tried to filibuster him. They tried to defeat him on a party, you know, on the final vote, and he was confirmed 52-48. In the current Senate, you know, he would have absolutely been filibustered. We're just living in a very different time where filibusters are, you know, de rigueur. They're the common thing that happens on almost every bill, and it seems like, and almost every nominee these days seems to have to go through this process. And so that ratcheting up on both parties, Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer helped sort of institutionalize the idea of filibustering court justices and other nominees in the early 2000s. Mitch McConnell, when Barack Obama took over, Mitch McConnell employed it and sort of supercharged the filibuster, and that's what prompted the first nuclear option. I mean, Mitch McConnell said certain positions he wouldn't confirm anybody, no matter who Obama nominated for them. And that was, you know, the Democrats basically said, well, that was the real nuclear option. And certainly last year, when Mitch McConnell did not even give a hearing to Merrick Garland, a lot of the Democrats say that was the real nuclear option as well. And some of them weren't willing to support any Trump nominee until Merrick Garland gets confirmed, which, of course, isn't going to happen.
Merrick Garland, of course, was the final appointee of President Obama, but the Senate wouldn't hold any hearings on the ground that an election was coming up in the next 8 to 10 months. Therefore, the people ought to decide, I think, was the phrase that they used. In any case, both parties have been involved in eroding this whole idea of requiring 60 votes for appointments to not just lower court members of the federal judiciary, but to the Supreme Court itself.
Yes, and the stakes are really super-duper high for this nominee as well as the next nominee. This nominee reinstates or is expected to reinstate a 5-4 majority for a bunch of conservative precedents like Citizens United, the campaign finance decision that allows unlimited spending on politics. And you could see in the next few years, you know, any number of the liberal justices who still support Roe v. Wade, if any one of them leaves, President Trump would have the ability to potentially put a justice on the court that could overturn Roe v. Wade and, frankly, a lot of other liberal precedents on a 5-4 basis. So that's what is in the back of the minds of a lot of these senators in both parties, and certainly all the interest groups on either side were going to the wall on this particular issue. They don't want any. There's no interest group out there urging Democrats and Republicans to sing kumbaya at this point.
Okay, so we'll be hearing about all these various options and the problems that might occur in the future as we go along. First, here's Senator Chris Dunes of Delaware, a Democrat, who said they're going to regret having done this.
We sometimes talk about the dysfunction of this body as if it is external to us, as if we bear no accountability for it. But at the end of the day, here we are, 100 men and women sent to represent 50 states of this republic and 325 million people. And in many ways, we have all let them down.
Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Michelle Jawando is vice president at Legal Progress. That's the legal policy arm at the Liberal Center for American Progress. Thanks for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me today.
So Senator Coons of Delaware, a Democrat, sounded like he was saying a plague on both houses. But do you think that the Democrats did the right thing today by forcing the action by the Republicans?
You know, I think it's important to put some context to what Democrats did today versus the power that the majority leader Mitch McConnell had in doing something else other than eliminating the rules. You know, I am a former Senate staffer. I am a proud Senate traditionalist, and today I am genuinely sad. I think there's been a lot of conversation about what Harry Reid did in 2013, but I think people should recognize that under all presidents before President Obama, so from George Washington to President Obama, cloture was only filed about 68 times on nominations. In the first 4 years of President Obama's term, Republicans filed cloture on 79 of Barack Obama's nominees.
Let me stop you for a moment. Tell our listeners, what's cloture?
Yeah, so when a nomination would like to move forward to receive a vote, if the minority refuses to agree to end debate, the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, or that time Harry Reid, they're forced to file a motion to stop the conversation and end debate. And that's essentially what cloture is. I want to end debate and vote on this nominee. And if you think about that over the arc of history, from George Washington to Barack Obama, 68 times, but during the first 4 years of Barack Obama's administration, 79 times. So the Senate had broken down. You saw Mitch McConnell use power of delay in a way we had never seen before in human history. And so that was the rules change in 2013. But even still, in spite of that delay, we carved out the Supreme Court. And why? Because the Supreme Court is where the most important decisions that happen in our country, where they end up. The Supreme Court is charged with interpreting our nation's laws and our constitutional rights. And Harry Reid and members of the Senate recognize we have to put that in a separate category. And today, Mitch McConnell destroyed that.
Michelle Giuando with Legal Progress at the Liberal Center for American Progress. Stephen Dennis, back to you at Bloomberg. A little more history here. When Senator Reid in 2013 did what was just described, Senator McConnell, who, of course, has been acting today in the same way, said it would go on Reid's tombstone that he presided over the end of the Senate.
Yeah, I know. I remember that vividly. And, you know, there's almost nothing that makes senators more hypocritical than when they go from the minority to the majority on what's the appropriate thing to do with these cases. I mean, when you're in the majority and you have the ability to do it, there's overwhelming pressure to say, hey, this is fine. We've got to get our person in, got to get our team in. And then you're on the other team and suddenly you know, those comments that Mitch McConnell made about the nuclear option being the worst thing ever. Now he's saying, well, we're just going back to the tradition of the first 200 years where almost nobody was ever filibustered, keeping in mind that this is a man, Mitch McConnell, who really weaponized the filibuster like nobody else before him. So it's, you know, there's a lot of pots calling the kettle black on both sides of this particular debate. But, you know, this potentially could have huge ramifications even in the next year or two, simply because there are a lot of big, huge, big ticket issues, whether it be health care and a whole bunch of other things. And there could be more and more pressure on Mitch McConnell to go nuclear on some of those issues as well. And Ted Cruz already today was telling reporters in the hallway that while there isn't support to get rid of the legislative filibuster now, we'll see. If the Democrats keep on fighting us too much, you know, we'll see if that changes.
Michelle Giuando, nonetheless, you wanted this to happen today. You wanted the Democrats to push it, even though they knew what Mitch McConnell was going to do. Do you think that was good politics?
You know, what I wanted is I wanted Mitch McConnell to do what presidents and Senate leaders have done before, which is let's make a deal. When President Clinton was in office, he recognized that there was a nominee, Bruce Babbitt, he couldn't move forward on. And what he did was he met with then Chairman Orrin Hatch of Utah and said, who can I move forward through the process? Who can receive consensus? Who can receive 60 votes? Mitch McConnell didn't do that. There were substantive reasons why Neil Gorsuch was a nominee that was not going to cross the 60-vote threshold. And instead of saying, you know what, Chuck, I recognize that there's a reason why we've had 60 votes for time immemorial, while seven of the eight Supreme Court justices that are currently sitting on the court have crossed over that threshold, I recognize that that's something important. So let's figure out if we can make a deal. And you saw at the last minute, Senator Schumer even tried to extend the time of when we could have the final vote on Neil Gorsuch to see if we can have 2 weeks of negotiation on a deal. And Mitch McConnell rejected that. And so you have to ask, the fault is not with the Democrats who were seeking to kind of uphold a precedent that even in 2013, when we changed the rules, we kept that same threshold. Today, the fault lies clearly at the feet of Mitch McConnell. And it's unfortunate for all Americans. I think that's the other piece. There are real people who are harmed when we can't have a bipartisan consensus candidate put on the court. And it's going to affect all of us.
And there was another argument made, which is that there's no rush about this because the Supreme Court is about to go into recess. There won't be much time for the new justice to even sit on the case, on the court, much less make any of the decisions that arguments have already been heard about. I want to go to Rick Hassin. He's a professor of law and political science at UC Irvine. He writes the Election Law blog. Rick Hassin, good to have you back with us. You're a liberal, and yet you're saying the timing on this was really bad.
Well, I should say first that the Supreme Court is hearing cases. They still have another round of cases beginning third week of April.
Okay, so there's more left then.
And there's a major case involving religion that Gorsuch will now be part of.
Okay.
And so that was one of the reasons Democrats were trying to delay a bit. But it wouldn't have made a big difference because if the court would have divided 4-4, they would just put the case over and hear it again when the next term begins next October.
Okay.
But my argument was not that Gorsuch is a mainstream candidate or one that those on the left should rally around, far from it, but that Democrats would have just one chance to make a lot of noise about the nuclear option, and they should save it for a time where replacing a justice would really move the court further to the right. What happened now is that Gorsuch essentially replaces Scalia, and while they may have differences on the margins, I expect that Gorsuch is going to vote very much like Scalia. But if you see Justice Kennedy go, which is a real possibility, or Justices Breyer or Ginsburg, the two oldest liberals on the court, then on the issues where Kennedy was the swing vote, it would be Roberts as the swing vote. Issues like affirmative action, issues like abortion, things could change very much. And the question was whether Democrats should have held their fire, knowing they were going to lose here today, for a time when they could maybe mobilize more and maybe get a few Republican senators, it would only take a few, to support keeping the old rules and thereby keeping someone who would change that balance on the court from going onto the court.
Stephen Dennis, you need to leave us. We have only about 15 seconds left. Oh, he's already gone. Okay, but quickly, Michelle Giwondo, wouldn't the Democrats have gotten an enormous amount of heat from the base of their party if they hadn't done this today?
I think, you know, whenever you have a Supreme Court vacancy, you have to think about 5-4 decisions and who they affect. And when you think about great decisions in the arc of history, Brown v. Board, Marbury v. Madison, unanimous, 5-4 decisions that have in recent history really divided our nation. And so every seat on the court counts. Okay. And I think that's why we had to fight on this.
Okay. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue with our other guest, Stephen Dennis with Bloomberg, had to go away. On our talking point later, Mar-a-Lago, now the Winter White House, a profitable new brand for President Donald Trump. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To The Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guest after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life. Warren Olney back with To The Point. Once again, the Senate has 100 people in it, and under the rules until today, you needed 60 votes in order to confirm an appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, the Republicans changed that, challenged to do so by the Democrats. They couldn't get the 60 votes, so the Republicans have changed the rules. Now it only takes 51 votes, and it's very likely that tomorrow, Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's first nominee, will in fact be confirmed. We've heard different liberals who have different views on this. Let's get a conservative into this argument. Jonathan Tobin is with us, conservative political analyst, contributor to the National Review and the Federalist, and an opinion editor at JNS World News. Good to have you back.
Great to be with you, Warren.
So did the Republicans today take a move for justice and truth and goodness, or did they, in fact, do something that was as political as it ever gets?
Oh, please. If there's anything about this whole discussion that I think drives, I think, most Americans crazy, it is the pretense of virtue, the pretense that either side really has any principle that they're standing on. I mean, everybody sort of rewrites the history to claim that they were always in the right. The fact is, this decision, as was true when Harry Reid did his version of the nuclear option, where you stand depends on where you sit. That's what this is about. This is a straight-up political dispute between conservatives, liberals, Republicans, and Democrats. And what happened is that the Republicans are now in a position where they can where they have the majority, they have the White House. I don't think we would have ever gotten back to 9 on the Supreme Court, no matter who had won the presidency or who had won the majority of the Senate last November, without doing this. Because that's where we are politically. There is no more, you know, there is no middle ground between the two parties. There is no acceptable nominee. I mean, when we talk about, oh, they could have come up with a more acceptable nominee that the Democrats would have liked, the only kind of nominee that the Democrats would have gone for is another Democrat, a liberal. And that, you know, Neil Gorsuch is probably the most moderate, most mainstream possible Republican judicial nominee. That's why they chose him first, assuming that Trump gets another chance. So if they weren't going to go for him, they weren't going to go for anybody. So this is where we are. It's not about principle. It's just about who controls the Supreme Court, who, you know, whether the conservative, the current conservative, the conservative majority that existed before Antonin Scalia died will be preserved or flipped to a liberal.
Michelle Jawando with the Center for American Progress, isn't that right?
I can't disagree more, but I appreciate the perspective. Listen, I think that before the hearings with Judge Gorsuch, there was this let's go in here. You know, people were still reeling from Merrick Garland, 293 days of not even giving Judge Garland a hearing or a vote, but they said let's hear him out, and I sat there over the last 4 days of that hearing. And what happened is Judge Gorsuch at many times came off with such a disdain for the process. There were a number of interactions between members of the committee. There was less candor on basic questions about the judge's judicial philosophy that institutionalists like Senator Leahy and Senator Feinstein remarked that there were questions that they had posed to multiple nominees of both sides, and Judge Gorsuch refused to give any insight into his philosophy. I think that there were a number of concerns beforehand, particularly on where Judge Gorsuch's record came down on workers' rights and whether or not he was going to be reliably independent from Mr. Trump and conservative groups. You know, it is worth noting that something happened with this nomination that was unique from all others. You had a president who laid out a series of litmus tests. And for your listeners, that's these are the things that this judge must rule on in order for us to appoint. That happened. The process was then outsourced to two organizations. And President Trump then said, I will select a candidate from that list and that list only. And then we are supposed to believe that when this nominee is presented, that he is completely ideologically neutral and would respect precedent on issues that even he disagrees with. And I think one of the cases that's referred to commonly as the Luke P. case that had to deal with an autistic boy, where the Supreme Court, as he was testifying, came out on the opposite directions, 8-0. There were a number of substantive reasons, and that gets lost in the fray.
Okay,
but
well,
really
let me go
important.
Back to Jonathan Tobin on this. There's an argument not so much about virtue and principle, but with regard to institutionalism. What about the concerns of Senators Leahy and Feinstein, who've been there for a long time, and given that Judge Gorsuch is in fact somewhat controversial, not just did in fact try to avoid substantive answers to his questions? Couldn't there have been some sort of negotiation about it, particularly given all the time that the Republicans refused to vote on Merrick Garland?
Warren, every nominee, frankly, since Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has played it this way. They understand that the more candid they are, the more likely they will be to be borked. Gorsuch
Bork
is
to
not
mean
a
that
controversial.
You're referring to Judge Bork, who was one of those that failed to be confirmed by the 60-vote margin. He was the nominee of Richard Nixon. Is that correct?
No. He was Ronald Reagan's
Ronald
nominee.
Reagan, I beg your pardon. It goes back even further. Go ahead.
He wasn't filibustered, and I think that's important to point out because filibusters for Supreme Court nominees are pretty much unknown until very recently.
Okay.
Bork in the late 80s opened up to the committee and, you know, gave the man full, complete, candid answers to everything, and he was crucified.
Okay.
And, you know, Ginsburg, when she came up, basically played it the complete opposite way, just what Gorsuch did. And that's what we've got now. That's the way the process is. The attempt to portray Gorsuch as some kind of extremely controversial nominee, that's just Democratic talking points. He's a mainstream conservative, and, you know, this is about, you know, sort of the passion of Merrick Garland, you know, waving the bloody shirt of what, you know, Democrats call a stolen seat.
Well, what about that? 293 days of not getting a hearing. That's a long time. And shouldn't the Senate have acted?
The point is, you know, listen, the Republicans played hardball last year. But the fact is, Garland would never have been confirmed. He didn't have a majority. The Republicans were never going to allow the court to be flipped from conservative to liberal while they still controlled the Senate. Democrats would not have done it had the position been reversed. As we heard often last year, Joe Biden in 92, Chuck Schumer in 2007, they made it clear they weren't going to confirm any last year George Bush nominees. So this gets back to where I started. The pretense of principle here is a joke, and voters see through it. I mean, and the idea that this is kind of be some sort of winning argument for Democrats. Yes, it's what their base needs. It's what their base wants. But if the passion of Merrick Garland, his martyrdom, and he was set up. I mean, he was never going to be confirmed. He never had the votes. It was never going to be his seat. And, you know, that was rough on him. And it was, you know, it was playing hardball. But the fact is, if outrage over that wasn't going to influence the 2016 election. I don't see how Democrats think they're going to do it in 2018. A year and a half from now, Neil Gorsuch is just going to be this guy who's been on the court for a year and a half.
Okay, let me go back to Rick Hassin again at UC Irvine, where he writes the election law blog. Once again, liberal who said the timing was wrong on this one should have waited for an even more conservative nominee, which is highly likely now that the 60-vote margin has been eliminated. We could argue about whether Merrick Garland was in fact acceptable to the Republicans or not. But what about the future? And who do you think might replace justices that have been named already by you and others who might retire or be eliminated from the court by other means?
Yeah, so let me just first disagree with the characterization that the next nominee could be more conservative than Gorsuch. I think that Gorsuch is going to turn out to be very conservative. I would probably think he's going to be of the ilk of Scalia and Thomas rather than Kennedy and Roberts, you know, if we're thinking about along a spectrum.
So that leaves the court then pretty much where it was prior to Scalia's death.
That's right. That's right. I think it's going to restore to where it was before, obviously different than it had Garland been the swing vote. But when Kennedy leaves, or which is, you know, there are some rumors that he might leave as soon as this summer, and there are signals coming from the Trump White House that they would try to nominate someone that would be acceptable to Kennedy, like one of his former clerks, such as D.C. Circuit Judge Brett Kavanaugh, that this might induce him to leave. When Kennedy leaves, or Ginsburg leaves, or Breyer leaves, if this is during the Trump administration and Republicans are still in control of the Senate, then I expect that even if we get someone of the same level of conservatism as Judge Gorsuch, that the court is going to move very far to the right, because it would mean that the median justice, the one in the middle, will no longer be Anthony Kennedy, who sides with Democrats not as often as he does with who sides with liberals, I should say, not as often as he does with conservatives, but enough. It would move that median to Chief Justice Roberts, who is a much more reliable vote on issues like abortion and affirmative action for conservatives than Kennedy has been. And in fact, what we would be counting on is that it would be Roberts who would not vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, because he would realize that's going to be politically disastrous for the Republican Party. And that's where the left is going to have to put all of its eggs.
So very quickly now, Ginsburg and Breyer are on the liberal side. Kennedy, as you pointed out, is somebody who has moved from one side to the other. So he's been the swing vote when there are nine justices serving, with four conservatives and four liberals. Do you have any idea that, can you elaborate on what you know about what Justice Kennedy has been told about the possibility if he should retire?
Well, there was a story in Politico today, and there was a story in the New York Times a few months ago, both seeming to be signals from the Trump administration that that if he decides to retire, he will be replaced with someone that would be acceptable to him, maybe one of his former clerks. And, you know, the signaling's been pretty blatant. The article in Politico today said that there were back channels of communication between Kennedy's kids and Trump's kids, so there'd be a way to have this kind of conversation off the record. And so I think that is – those conversations are going on, and Kennedy is known for agonizing, and the rumors are that he's agonizing about whether he should leave the court, maybe this year, maybe next year.
So Kennedy's kids and Trump's kids know each other?
Apparently so.
Jonathan Tobin, what do you say to that one? That's pretty interesting.
It's a small political world among the elites, isn't it? Listen, I think, you know, we can read tea leaves. Who knows what Justice Kennedy will do? It's being a Supreme Court justice is a pretty good gig. Usually they have to be carried out of there. So I'm not counting on I think nobody should count on that. But the point is, you know, we are where we are in terms of, you know, as Barack Obama said, elections have consequences. And right now, Democrats would like to relitigate the 2016 election if they can. Some are hoping that, you know, maybe they'll buy a winning lottery ticket and find something about Trump and Russia and make the bad dream go away. But the fact is, there's a Republican majority in the Senate, there's a Republican president, And we have a political system right now and two political parties that are so far apart with no middle ground between them where, you know, again, we just come back to both sides at times pretend to have virtue. Neil Gorsuch is
okay,
not—
Well, wait a minute. Let me go back to Michelle Jawando on this because we're running short of time. What do you say to the argument then by Rick Hassan that it would have been better to wait instead of pushing the issue today by the Democrats, wait until there's more at stake, which would be presumably the next appointee by President Trump, should he get the opportunity for one?
You know, I as I shared, you know, I've spent many years on the Senate, and I think you would have to first believe that any kind of deal that you would make with Mitch McConnell would actually be something that you could trust. And I think, unfortunately, the erosion of trust in the Senate has so broken down that I think that that was, in many ways, one of the reasons you couldn't find a middle ground.
Would the liberals, the liberal side of the Democratic Party, the so-called base of the party, tried to run liberals against conservatives, or against, not conservatives, but against Democrats that didn't vote this way today, next year? Would there have been a high price for them to pay if they hadn't done them?
But I actually don't think that liberals or progressives in the Senate had to resort to what the base wanted them to do. They had only to look at Judge Gorsuch's record and make a decision, and the conclusion was that he is not someone who would look on workers' issues or issues around
the
environment.
Aren't politics, though, very much involved, as Jonathan Tobin insists? Not just the question of what's right and what's wrong, but whether I'm going to get elected, reelected next year.
Right, but I think that is connected, right? If you are the Democrat who votes for someone who then quickly eviscerates a woman's rights to choose or votes against these protections, then the people, your constituents, are those who suffer. And so they then look at that. And I think that is something that no one wants to say, I voted to support that. I mean, if you even look at how some people felt about Chief Justice Roberts and then what happened with Shelby County and breaking down the Voting Rights Act, there are some people who regretted that decision. And I think that's where many more people will find themselves with a quote unquote Justice Gorsuch.
Right. And there are others who say that Chief Justice Roberts saved Obamacare. So obviously the beat goes on. And I want to thank all of you for being part of this program. Michelle Jawando, once again, Vice President of Legal Progress. That's the legal policy arm at the Center for American Progress. Thanks to Jonathan Tobin, contributor to the National Review and the Federalist, Rick Hassan, professor of political science, UC Irvine, writes the Election Law blog, and our earlier guest, Stephen Dennis, at Bloomberg News. Great to have you all. In a moment, another branding triumph for America's resort owner-in-chief on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Norman Alna here with today's talking point. President Trump's summit meeting with China's President Xi Jinping starts today at Mar-a-Lago, Mr. Trump's ultra-luxurious club for members only, now being called the Winter White House. So it's a daily subject of extensive news coverage, and of course that means free publicity as well. Does that raise ethics questions? Does it tarnish the conduct of American diplomacy? Robert Weissman says it does. He is president of Public Citizen. That's the nonprofit government watchdog founded by Ralph Nader. Good to have you on our program, Robert Weissman.
Hey, great to be with you, Warren.
Tell us why you think this raises ethics questions and what it means for American diplomacy and the image of the country.
Well, the president has turned himself into a walking advertisement for his various resort properties around the country and around the world. He has rarely missed a weekend opportunity to venture to one Trump property or another. and most significantly, visiting repeatedly to the Florida resort Mar-a-Lago, where this upcoming summit's going to be held. There's just no way to get around that. Each time he does that, he is advertising for his properties, his resorts, and it's a kind of crash commercialism that is absolutely degrading to the office of the presidency, and is just unfortunate, even bizarre, in terms of a venue to conduct a really important foreign policy negotiation.
Well, tell us more about Mar-a-Lago. We know it's a nice place to be.
Apparently, the members think so. They pay a $100,000 initiation fee. It's recently jumped to $200,000. We don't know the names of the people there, but that price tag alone is enough to tell us that it is a very select group, selected not based on attributes that might make them great Americans, but attributes of having tons of money. We also know from the president's style and experience on his visits as president to Mar-a-Lago that he's effectively using the members of Mar-a-Lago as a focus group to talk about things that are on his mind. So you have this slice of the super rich giving feedback to the president and helping determine policy in the process. It's just a horrible way to conduct American policymaking, and a horrible way for the president to conduct himself.
The New York Times has published a list of some of the members. They include one of the Koch brothers and some energy CEOs as well.
Yeah, that's right. And the Times was able to track down some of the members and talk to them. And people weren't shy about talking, explaining what their experience had been. I guess they were pretty excited about it because they have now this access to the president. These are people who bought into the club not expecting that Donald Trump would be president, so they've luckily found themselves with this access to the president, and they're using it, and he's inviting it. They actually describe whispering in his ear to give him advice on different things, or randomly having him suggest they ought to bid on government contracts, including to build the horrible wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So they are getting tons of access, as are the resort members at other of his clubs and properties around the country.
The General Accounting Office says that it costs about $3.6 million every time the president goes to his own private club, Mar-a-Lago. That includes $180,000 an hour for Air Force One. It's $2.8 million altogether for support aircraft and military personnel. And also there's the Secret Service, the Coast Guard. They added nearly $800,000. Are there less expensive places that he could take people, have summit meetings, for example, that other presidents have used?
Yes, Camp David. I mean, that's sort of the go-to place. It's government-owned property. It's designed to handle visiting delegations. It offers privacy and appropriate levels of luxury and accommodation, and it would be far cheaper. But, you know, President Trump wants to go to Donald Trump's properties and advertise them. So Camp David is sitting lonely in Maryland. The president has spent upwards of $23 million, or the government has spent upwards of $23 million accommodating him on his trips to Mar-a-Lago. Even if you don't count the other security that's being provided for the family, he's on track to spend more in 1 year than President Obama did in the entirety of his 8-year presidency on travel-related expenses, which is especially notable because private citizen Trump and candidate Trump regularly and routinely disparage President Obama for his expenses, but they're going to turn out to be about 1/8, maybe, of what Donald Trump is spending.
How does this cost compare to some of the budget cuts that the president has proposed?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. He obviously his budget proposals talk about zeroing out a wide range of programs for the poor, or slashing them down to very low levels, including such popular programs as Meals on Wheels and heating oil assistance for low-income people and cold parts
of the country. It turns out, and the New York Times is reporting on this today, that these expenses are actually stressing the budget of the Secret Service, both the budget and the capacity of the agents in the Secret Service. They're so busy tracking where Donald Trump goes, where the Trump children go, maintaining security in New York for the First Lady and her young son, that they are massively stretched out, and the budget is not sufficient to accommodate the demands that Donald Trump expansive family is imposing on them.
Is this good for Palm Beach, Florida?
Not according to the residents. They're finding that their airport is getting shut down. A lot of the business along the beach where Mar-a-Lago is located is getting shut down. Entrance into the beachside property there is limited. And so the security is making it either very difficult or impossible to get in. You have a lot of local businesses saying that they're really hurting. And, of course, Palm Beach itself is having to spend enormous amounts on security that they don't have budgeted. It's just random that the president is imposing these costs on them in ways that they had no reason to anticipate.
Other presidents have not used Camp David. George H.W. Bush liked people to come to Kennebunkport in Maine. George W. Bush, Crawford, Texas, he had a ranch there. President Obama used to use the Sunnylands Estate out near Palm Springs in California. How is that different from Mar-a-Lago?
Well, it's different, at least so far, both in terms of the quantity and qualitatively. Quantity, because so far Trump has gone away almost every weekend. He's gone away almost every weekend, or every time he's done so, it's been to a Trump-branded property. He's gone to Mar-a-Lago repeatedly. He's now held these summits with Japanese leader and now the Chinese leader upcoming at his estate, and not using Camp David at all, which is different than the prior presidents you're referencing. And, of course, the biggest and most obvious difference is when they went to all these places, they may have gone to their personal properties or they may have gone to commercial properties, but they never went to their own commercial properties. They never had they were never effectively conferring this enormous publicity and advertising campaign for their own commercial properties. I think there is no precedent for anything like it in American history.
All right. President Trump also has apparently made 17 trips to golf courses that he owns.
That's right. He loves to golf and only at Trump courses.
Okay. So you think that's good for business at those courses, perhaps?
It's absolutely driving attention to them. And if although he continues to own his businesses, although he is not running them, but his sons, who are running the family business, are explicit that they are using the publicity that they're getting from the presidency to try to vault their business to new levels.
All right. Robert Weissman, again, president of Public Citizen, nonprofit government watchdog group founded by Ralph Nader. Great to have you on our program. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.